Good morning, everyone. We are working here in A Treatise on White Magic, and this is video commentary number 8. We're working on spirit, life, and energy. And I think here in White Magic, we're getting the most complete definitions of these factors which form the foundation for future study. So he somehow is approaching them in a different way, a more complete way than he does in some other later books. We've discussed the idea of spirit. Is it being? Is it life? Is life being? Spirit turns out to be an energy which exists in universe. It's a driving, propulsive force. It has much to do with the divine will. Is it pure being? Well, it depends on the context in which it is used. Here, I think, as it is presented here, it is not pure being, but something that is derivative of pure being or from pure being. One of the first lessons, he says, we need to learn is that our minds, being as yet unresponsive to hidden intuitions, notice how he identifies with us, who are much lesser students on the path than he is, so our minds, being as yet unresponsive to the hidden intuitions, make it impossible for us to say with assurance, that a condition is this, that, or the other. We are still somewhat in the speculative realm, although we are exercising discriminative knowledge, and to a much lesser extent, intuitive knowledge, but not really yet, because we are not Buddhically focused. We are occasionally Buddhically receptive without being always Buddhically focused. That until we can function in our soul consciousness, and not simply occasionally receptive to it, it is not for us to say what is or what is not. So this is a amazing call to humility, that adjusted, how does he say it, adjusted sense of right proportion. Right. That until we have submitted ourselves to the needed training, we are in no position to deny or affirm anything. We can propose the possibility and also say, thus have I heard, or according to the Tibetan, according to the Tibetan, according to the teaching, or the teaching. Sorry, I can't get that. Our attitude should be that of reasonable inquiry, and our interest that of the investigating philosopher, willing to accept an hypothesis on the basis of possibility, but being willing to acknowledge as proven truth anything, but being unwilling to acknowledge as proven truth anything until we know it for ourselves. Now, we know that many people err in this and assert the accuracy of their knowledge under all circumstances. This is hardly wise to do, and is based upon a fear of being incorrect, and it's based upon impatience. It's really based upon insecurity of the knowledge one asserts. The open-minded investigator is most interested in truth and not in the knowledge, not in the fact that he or she is asserting the accuracy of a certain kind of knowledge. The lower ego gets identified with that assertion, and the assertion arises because of the attempt to protect the lower ego, and it does not serve the cause of truth. I, an aspirant to the higher mysteries, and okay, notice how he calls himself as a master. Well, of course, maybe it had not been given out yet. Let's just say it had not been given out who he was yet. But still, he calls himself an aspirant. And any reader of his material, Cosmic Fire Came First, before this book, would know the tremendous depth and scope of his knowledge. I, an aspirant to the higher mysteries, and one who has searched into them for a longer period than has been possible as yet to many, and I would say, would you not, thousands of years, as he was a Greek scholar and also a Buddhist scholar, may write of things as yet impossible to demonstrate to you or to the public who may read these instructions. So we see that Master Moria's mine of trust is so very important. We have to have the reasonable and reasoning faith based upon the accuracy and of much that has been given and the seeming accuracy of still more. So I, an aspirant to the higher mysteries, and we are simply aspirants to the lower mysteries, and one who has searched into them for a longer period than has been possible as yet to many, may write of things as yet impossible of demonstration to you or to the public who may read these instructions. We are not exactly the public. We are, you know, the specialized aspirants and disciples, highly focused, and the general public has not heard much of these things. But once, of course, we were members of the general public and found our way into a closer relationship with the sources of truth. To me, they may be and are truth and proven fact, and for me, that may suffice. For you, they should be regarded as significant possibilities and hints as to the direction in which truth may be sought. So he's giving us the proper attitude, but beyond that, you should not permit yourself to go. All right, so the boundaries are being drawn. The value of these instructions lie in their sum total and is to be found in the underlying structure or skeleton of coordinated and correlated statements, which must be considered as a whole and not in detail, and this for two reasons. So all of these are caveats concerning the extent of the knowledge we may gather from our reading of the Tibetan and meditation upon his words. All right, so where is the value? It lies in the sum total and the many correlated statements. I think those who are true students of the Tibetans' work will realize that as they study through the years, the many books, they will be correlating what is found in one book and what is found in another, and that these correlations will shed a degree of, let's call it probable light. It seems like light. It may be light. It may be convincing, but we have to hold to its probability rather than assert its certainty. We are not at a stage in our development where we can assert its certainty. Later we will, using the same kind of word, ascertain its truth or falsity. Language, so he's telling us we must not go too much into detail, and why is that? Language, he says, as earlier said, hides truth and does not reveal it. This is not too encouraging a statement for those of us who work hard to represent what we think the truth to be in ever more refined language. I suppose it is an effort we must attempt, but we must not have the certainty that the word is the thing. If truth is recognized, it is because the investigating student has found a point of truth in himself, which serves to illumine his steps as he slowly and gradually presses forward. So this is the sane way of viewing our progress. And so many seem to choose the fast way. To them it's fast. They think it's fast. In which certainty about things is prematurely asserted. The next statement, why we should consider this as a whole and not in detail or excessive detail anyway. There are many types of minds, and it is not to be expected that the information given, for instance, in this treatise will appeal to all. You know, Ray and astrological types, which have developed over many years in diverse ways and on diverse lines. So not all things can appeal to all people. That's quite obvious. Otherwise, we would have a very monochromatic humanity. It should be remembered that all people are units of consciousness breathed forth on one of the seven emanations of God. Just want to make sure that we've got this correct. This breathing forth is the dynamic associated with emanation, a very important process, and one that is seen constantly in Buddhist scripture and in Buddhist art, which attempts to present the truth in pictorial form. So here we are, all units of consciousness, breathed forth on one or other of the seven emanations of God. Therefore, even their monads, or spiritual aspects, are inherently different. Well, I would say this, maybe not at the core, but in terms of the vehicles through which the essential monad manifests. Because at the core, of every monad is pure being, which is identical under all purposes, under all circumstances. But we know what the Tibetan means, the seven different ray types of monads found on the monadic plane. Therefore, even their monads or spiritual aspects are inherently different, just as in the prism, which is one, there are seven differentiated colors. And here is the hint that seven monadic types are to be found. Even this is so only because of the nature and point of view and the perceiving apparatus of man, whose eye registers and differentiates the varying rates of vibratory light. We remember that the seven rays are called the seven rays of light. Okay. These seven subsidiary groups again produce a varying outlook, mentality, and approach, all equally right, but all presenting a slightly different angle of vision and meaning is associated with angle of vision. When the above realization is coupled to such factors as the different points in evolution, varying nationalities and characteristics, the inherent distinctions brought about through the interplay between the physical body involved and the environment, it will be apparent that no approach to such abstruse subjects as the nature of spirit and soul could have a general definition and submit themselves to a universal terminology. We are still too immersed in distinction, necessarily so. So, you know, so many of us are somehow working with the Tibetan, which means that we are essentially working on the second ray as it manifests through one or other of our vehicles, especially the soul or monadic vehicles. As DK has said, you know, I'll paraphrase that, if you're going to be working with me for a long time and find me to be your teacher and remain in my group, then one of your major vehicles is going to be found on the second ray. It may not be the soul, but if it isn't, it will probably be the monad. And so many of his first ray disciples, I would estimate, had the second ray monad, those who were first ray in their soul nature, had the second ray monad. Maybe not all, you know, obviously rules exist to have exceptions. And we cannot get deeply enough into the psychology of each of those disciples to know whether this tendency applies to all of them. I'm thinking that there was a seventh ray soul who may have had a first ray monad. That would be a very powerful combination, and not on the second ray at all. But anyway, we'll learn more about this as we advance in esoteric psychology. So now we've been studying spirit, life, and energy, that propulsive something which drives all units of life into some kind of soul differentiation, some kind of qualitative differentiation, and then further into expression. And as long as the breath proceeds to go forth and be withdrawn and go forth and be withdrawn, then there will be a sustainment of those units of life in their various levels of immersion in matter. But should the spirit withdraw entirely, then there will be the disappearance of those manifestations. So I hope we, you know, have a little better idea just read and reread these sections of the book, and you know, you can pause here and reread my notes if you wish. The life principle manifesting as directional will, as coherent force, and as the activity. That's the third ray word of atoms and cells. And the word, I think I'll put that in here. The word activity. Oh, goodness. I don't seem to be able to reach that point. No. Activity. Pertains to the third ray. Third ray of activity. And of abstract mind, the ray of creative intelligence, but it is the ray of activity primarily. Okay. So reread these things and study them as you can. You know, always reserve for yourself sufficient time, if possible, to study and restudy what has been so abundantly presented to us, and we will not regret that if we do that. You know, oftentimes we're told meditation, study, and service. These are the ways of real spiritual advancement and the ways to help the inner workers. And, you know, we have to look at the balance of these in our life, because sometimes we do tend to de-emphasize or to ignore one or the other. And we should try to keep a balance. Maybe service ends up being the most important of all. And there are some moments in the teaching when DK writes that more advancement, progress, can be achieved through service even than through meditation. It shows that there's a very strong influence of the Christ, which is operative, because he was above all and is the great server. Okay, well, now we go to the next extensive description. It's no longer spirit, life, and energy. It's the soul, the mediator, or middle principle. And that's that type of consciousness is what we at our stage of evolution are trying to achieve. We may be taking two curricula at the same time in a way, and via the Antikarana availing ourselves of the impulse of the spirit. But that is a more advanced curriculum, and until we've established our ability to live consciously as a soul and within the periphery of the causal body, egoic lotus, then we still have much to learn about still more advanced states. So, you know, many people get confused about soul, solar angel, angel of the presence, human soul, soul on its own plane, soul as consciousness. It's a word that is used in many varying contexts. It's quite fluid, and we may have difficulty pinning down a definition which really seems to bring the light to us. But behind the objectivity of the personality is an observer, a presence, which we are. And if all of those personality vehicles were to fall away, this presence would still be there. Now, of course, everything is the monad in a way. Everything is spirit. Everything is the emanation of being, whether it's personality, soul, or triad or monad, you know, all these technical terms, it's all derivative from the essential reality. But in time and space, and given our type of limitations, we have to differentiate in order to understand, at least initially, more deeply. There are two angles or points of view from which the nature of the soul must be grasped. You see, even monad has soul, if soul is consciousness. Soul is a state of sensitivity, of apprehension, of the nature of the object which is perceived through its means, through its agency. And we seek the growth of soul, which means we seek the growth of consciousness as we lessen our immersion in universal objectivity. Our immersion has closed down our scope and depth of soul, our scope and depth of consciousness. And we have to learn to expand the soul, expand the consciousness, expand our depth of appreciation, widen and deepen our ring past knot. This seems to be the universal process. Immersion, deep immersion into limitation, and then retraction of that immersion. There are two angles or points of view from which the nature of the soul must be grasped, he says. One is the aspect of the soul in relation to the fourth kingdom of nature, the human, and we oftentimes call that the human soul. And the other, that of the subhuman kingdoms in nature, which, it must be remembered, are reflections of the three higher. And here we're talking about the anima mundi, the, quote, soul of the world. I guess all demonstrations of soul on this planet are expressions of the anima mundi, of the soul of the world. And, of course, you know, there are higher expressions of soul as well. The great beings that exist on higher planes, they also have or work through soul. We're not just talking about the consciousness which is limited by the causal body, by the egoic lotus. And to that, we usually ascribe the name soul. But it's a much larger concept, and eventually we find that there is a universal soul altogether. It should be borne in mind that the soul of matter, the anima mundi, is the sentient factor in substance itself. All right, this is one way of looking at anima mundi, and it is a limited way of doing so. But let's just say it's this approach to anima mundi, does not feature self-consciousness, which seems to arise when we reach the human stage. So it is simply sensitivity. Let's call it this. Let's call it sensitivity without self-consciousness. But always there is the self-conscious factor on the higher planes, and the group conscious factor, which is beyond self-consciousness, which from the group conscious angle is considered to be a limitation. And then there is the monadic consciousness or awareness of the one, which still higher beings preserve. Sylvius Animal Mundi, as he's describing it here, it is the responsiveness of matter throughout the universe and that innate faculty in all forms, from the atom of the physicist, and I suppose the subatomic particle now, to the solar system of the astronomer, which produces the undeniable intelligent activity which they all demonstrate. Lately there's been a debate about whether there is intelligent design, and the religiously inclined people think of this intelligent design as indicating the presence of a god, however they define that, and the more scientific types find no reason to speak of the truth of intelligent design. They don't see it as necessary. But I think if one looks with great care, one will find a profound intelligence, a principle of intelligent organization, organizing the various types of beings that we find in cosmos. All right, this Anima Mundi, it can be called attractive energy, coherency, sentiency, aliveness, awareness, or consciousness. But perhaps the most illuminating term is that the soul is the quality which every form manifests. So here are diverse names for the for soul, for the soul of the world, the soul of matter, that responsiveness of matter throughout the universe. There is no such thing as non-ensouled matter, as inanimate matter, because the anima in this case is soul, so we don't have really inanimate substance at all. Everything is animate. Everything has this responsiveness to sentiency. So the names he uses, attractive energy, you know, it seems to be always connected with the second aspect. Coherency, it holds things together. Sentiency, it's responsive. Aliveness, people will dispute whether inanimate matter is alive, but the occultist says yes. Awareness, some type of relationship from one unit of life to another, no matter how circumscribed, or consciousness, but perhaps the most illuminating term is the quality. And we read very much in esoteric psychology that the soul is the quality of life. And we have that triplicity, which is quite illuminative, life, quality, and appearance, relating pretty much to the first three rays. And in that case, life does not mean pure being. It's related to the first ray, the driving, sustaining energy behind everything. Soul is that. He's trying in various ways to, you know, give us words so that we can wrap our minds around this factor in creation. It is that subtle something which distinguishes one element from another, one mineral from another. This distinction is quality. So the type of distinctions of which he is speaking is quality. It is the intangible, essential nature of the form which in the vegetable kingdom determines whether a rose or a cauliflower, an elm or a watercress shall come into being. So it it determines the relationships which evidence themselves as differentiation. As you know, he's given us these differentiations in the plant kingdom, and Certainly we can distinguish between a rose and a cauliflower, but it's the soul aspect which has made that distinction, because it has produced a geometrical relationship or some kind of internal relationship between the factors which compose the form, and those relationships are distinct and emerge as distinctly perceived differences in the form. An elm tree or a watercress, goodness, what a contrast. It is a type of energy which distinguishes the varying species of the animal kingdom and makes one man different from another in his appearance, nature, and character. So, soul carries distinction. You know, ultimately, there is no distinction in the realm of being. All things that are simply are, you know, and in the isness of them, we have their commonality, regardless of their apparently distinct quality, as observed by the differentiating mind. But there is a way to look at all things, regardless of their apparent differentiations, and see them as the same, as externalizations of the one infinite being. The scientist has tabulated, investigated, and analyzed the forms, you know, using the fifth ray in what here is a second ray context. Names have been selected and given to the elements and the minerals, the forms of vegetable life and the varying species of animals, the structures of the forms, you know, comparative anatomy as a discipline, academic discipline, and the history of their evolutionary progress has been studied, and deductions and conclusions have been reached. But the solution of the problem of life itself still eludes the wisest, and until the understanding of the web of life, or the body of vitality which underlies every form and links every part of a form with every other part, is recognized and known to be a fact in nature, the problem will be unsolved. All right, the solution still evades. The form causative nature of the etheric body must be investigated. And we're just beginning. We are just now beginning to do this. So during the Aquarian Age, we have so much of revelation, which is destined to merge, and the masters have to be careful that it doesn't happen too fast. Otherwise, humanity gets overwhelmed, and its gradual, safe, and sane evolutionary method will be disrupted. Okay. Well, we're seeing that there, you know, life is one and non-differentiable, but when that factor of soul enters in, differentiation occurs. So life is one and essentially non-differentiable. But when the factor of soul enters, differentiation enters as well. I guess it is important to be able to see sameness and difference simultaneously. So learn, all of us, to see sameness and differentiation simultaneously. And then we will see, we will understand both being and soul, or oneness and soul. Okay, let's put that down. Oneness and soul will then be understood. We're dealing with words, you know. And words can be used in many different ways, so it's important for us to clearly define our terms and know what a particular term means to us and labor carefully to convey that meaning to others so that we actually understand each other. You know, the old Voltaire statement, if any man would converse with me, let him define his terms. I've mentioned it more than once. It always struck me as a very important condition for mutual understanding. And, of course, it suggests the fifth ray, and he had that kind of ability as well. The definition of the soul may be regarded as somewhat more feasible than that of spirit, owing to the fact that there are many people who have experienced at some time or another an illumination, an unfoldment, an uplifting, and a beatitude, a blessing, which has convinced them that there is a state of consciousness so far removed from that normally experienced as to bring them into a new state of being and a new level of awareness. So, the definition of soul, DK is saying, more accessible because of human experience. And there are many people who have experienced the light, or greater light, or greater uplift of the consciousness and a growing awareness of different and higher states of vibration, which we call higher states of being. Ultimate being is one, but there, you know, as the word being is used relatively, we encounter what we call different states of being. It is sometimes felt and experienced and involves that psychic expansion which the mystic has registered down the ages. You know, and this psychic expansion has often been called contacting. Let's give ourselves a new word here, and we'll call it this, and see if we can. Okay, we'll call it the presence. Oh, what is the matter here? Okay, presence of God. We'll call it that. This Finnish keyboard is a little different from the English keyboard, American keyboard. Right. Psychic expansion, which mystics deemed to be the presence of God, which the mystic has registered down the ages, and which St. Paul referred to as being caught up to the third heaven. DK also talked about St. Paul registering seventh heaven. So St. Paul was elevated, a mystic elevation, though really, you know, we can say of him being so strongly on the fifth ray, monadically considered, that he was an occultist and later appeared, I believe, as the Neoplatonist theurgist known as Iamblichus. Right. St. Paul referred to as he spoke of being caught up to the third heaven. Okay. And of hearing things there which it is not lawful for man to utter. So, you know, in terms of what DK has written about, St. Paul understood something. St. Paul understood what has been called occult silence. and keeping the content of his mind well differentiated, and knowing what could be uttered or even thought in certain contexts, and what it was forbidden to utter or even to think in other contexts. When hearing and sight on those levels are both producing registered experience, then we have the occultist plus the mystic. And we, you know, from the astrological point of view, you realize this means Uranus plus Neptune. And really, both are necessary. We have so much discussion and differentiation about occultists and mystics and so forth, as if it's quite undesirable to be a mystic and far better to be an occultist. But the true occultist has blended his sensitive mysticism with his new scientific occultism. And these are the two of the greatest synthesizing planets. And we, you know, we find them, let's see here. There they are, Uranus and Neptune, as if separated from the great number of planetary schemes, which comprise what we might call the esoteric Saturn. They're all under the Saturnian control and in the Saturnian system, but the other two, which are not really geometrically portrayed here with accuracy, cannot yet be, are above and beyond the realm of Saturn. Okay. All right. So when hearing and sight on those levels, such as the, you know, what is the third heaven? It's really the, we call it the realm of the higher mind. And of hearing things there, maybe seeing things too, which it is not lawful for man to utter, when hearing and sight on those levels are both producing registered experience, then we have the occultist plus the mystic. And I would say, especially when it is possible to return at will to those states, and not just, is there such a word here, happenstantially. Maybe there's no such word, but by happenstance, you know. Not knowing how you got there, but somehow arriving. Happenstantial. Happenstantially. Okay. Now, the soul, macrocosmic and microcosmic, universal and human, is that entity which is brought into being when the spirit aspect and the matter aspect are related to each other. And my question has always been, my question, does it require soul in order to relate the spirit and matter aspects? And I think I have not solved that problem yet. Does it require consciousness to differentiate spirit matter, we can call it that, into spirit and matter? So there are some philosophical questions there that need examination, you know. And obviously, when you think the Tibetan has it right, which we have every reason to believe he does, and you find that your understanding is, given your present limitations, is other, or apparently other, than what is normally presented, then you have a responsibility to think very deeply about what may be the reason for the apparent contradiction or inconsistency. And that's where I am with this issue of the creation of matter, which I think is an act of self-observation, I've often said. The creation of matter may be an act of self-observation, matter as distinctly objective. All right. Anyway, that will be solved as we go along. Maybe it's already solved for many, but at least in my own mind, I have to go with what I think is necessary. So, we have here the soul, and it's brought into being when spirit and matter, subject and object, are related. But then how do you get the object? That's the question. The soul, therefore, is neither spirit nor matter, but is the relation between them. And that, of course, is an important concept, and with it, one necessarily has to agree. Whenever we have the word soul, we must think also of the word relation. The soul is the mediator between this duality. The Son mediates between the Father and the Mother. Consciousness mediates between the observer or the spirit and the form. Quality mediates life quality appearance between life and appearance and so forth. It's the middle principle. So we understand soul is the, and it's been said many times, middle principle. The soul is the mediator between duality, is the middle principle, the link between God and his form. Therefore, soul is another name for the Christ principle, whether in nature or in man. All right, these are the definitions that we are accustomed to. It's going to be quite a bit about this, and it's going to be extensive. So we are soon reaching the point where this hour-long program will conclude. And yet we, as I look ahead here, I see we have probably even two more programs on how soul is here presented. Well, you know, let these definitions sink in and try to find yourself in that mediating place by disidentifying with what we usually consider to be objective. Of course, even the causal body or egoic lotus will seem like an object, and to what does it seem like an object? Well, to a recessing soul consciousness, it will seem like an object. Finally, anything that has come out of the universal logos in all its incredible emanative variety will seem objective. And to what will it seem objective? It will seem objective to the universal soul. So remember that soul is a universal principle, a cosmic principle, and is not simply to be confined to the limitations of the higher mental plane. Maybe a little more here. The soul is the attractive force of the creative universe, and when functioning, holds all forms together so that the life of God may manifest and express itself through them. So, you know, under the systemic law, called the well, maybe not. Law of cohesion. All the various factors in universe are held in coherency. So it is identified with the second aspect of divinity, and you know, when the soul force withdraws from the dense physical body, or for any one of our personality vehicles, disintegration will ensue. Therefore, the soul is the form-building aspect, and what a variety of forms there are that are built, and is that attractive factor in every form in the universe, in the planet. What a jump there, unless universe means the solar system. In the universe, in the planet, in the kingdoms of nature, and in man, who sums up in himself all the aspects, which brings the form into being and enables it to develop and grow, so as to house more adequately the indwelling life, and which drives all God's creatures forward along the path of evolution through one kingdom after another towards an eventual goal and glorious consummation. That's a marvelous definition, again, of soul, and one that we want to highlight and maybe read again. Therefore, the soul is the form-building aspect and is that attractive factor in every form in the universe, in the planet, in the kingdoms of nature, and in man, who sums up in himself all the aspects, which brings the form into being. You know, actually the soul is that which is bringing the personality of man into being, which enables it to develop and grow so as to house more adequately the indwelling life, you know, to withstand the pressure of that indwelling life. The building has to be strong and correct, and which drives all God's creatures. It has a driving power too. We have to remember that the soul has a driving power. It drives all creatures forward along the path of evolution through one kingdom after another towards an eventual goal and glorious consummation. This is the first ray aspect of soul. And bringing forms into being is the second ray. Is the third ray aspect of soul, and enables it to grow and develop and grow. And let's just say this is the second ray aspect of soul. DK thinks in this way. He's always listing a kind of a numerical system under much of what he says, and he tries to ensure that the different aspects are properly represented. The soul is the force of evolution itself, and was in the mind of St. Paul when he spoke of the Christ in you, the hope of glory. The soul representing, manifesting, overseeing growth, driving forward, all towards a glorious consummation, which is our hope, of course, being immersed as we are so deeply in objectivity. So this will be the end of a treatise on white magic video commentary number 8. And what page are we on? We're on page 35. So I guess it's page 31 to 35. And am I correct here? There's no telling. Let's see where we are here. Yeah. 31 to 35. Okay. Well, it's so interesting to dwell on these things, to ponder on them, to stay with them, and to allow that pondering to bring in the light. So we're still working in the next program with DK's definition of soul. And this will be now here the beginning of A Treatise on White Magic video commentary number 9, and starting with page 35. Okay, friends, so that's going to be it for the moment, and we will continue our work together at the next possible opportunity, always expanding our knowledge and our consciousness and our sensitivity and our resultant ability in service and our contact with the One until we identify as the One. See you before long. Bye-bye.